While several high-profile and controversial measures in the governor's proposed budget have worked their way through the legislature's Joint Finance Committee, other parts of the budget are still up for debate.
One such issue is a measure that would cap the amount of money available through Wisconsin's Historic Tax Credits Program, which provides incentives for builders and developers to rehabilitate historic buildings.
That would come just a year after the state increased the incentives available. More than $35 million in tax incentives were approved in 2014, and a report out last week indicated the program offers a net gain to the state. Matt Jarris is a Milwaukee architect and directs the Historic Preservation Institute at UWM, and he joins us in the studio. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you very much.
Why would you contend historic tax credits are so important in the scheme of a downtown's economic health?
Everybody knows that there are kind of levels of complexity and uncertainty to retaining and restoring historic buildings, particularly those that are in the range of sort of 100, 120, 130 years old. And of course, in Milwaukee and a lot of American cities, that's about the age we're getting at with so many of those buildings. We found a lot out about good, economical, thoughtful ways to restore them. But it's going to take a while for that kind of information to get out, and also to have creditors and developers confident that they understand the cost before they go into a project.
Is there evidence that shows developers would otherwise not take on these projects if not for the existence of these tax credits?
Well, I think that Wisconsin is a pretty good case study, a real clear example of that. We have now for up until last year had just a 5% historic tax credit in the state of Wisconsin. All the surrounding states have had 20 or 25%, and their rate of projects and investment are much higher than in Wisconsin. And that's data that was taken over a 13-year period. So it's a fairly good number that shows that at least up to last year, we were far behind the rest of the Midwest.
Well, and so what happened last year? How does the existence of this tax credit program show what can be done?
Sure. I'll just explain a couple basic things about a tax credit program or the tax credit program. The federal tax credit that helps to promote the retention of historic buildings offers developers and owners of buildings, for-profit, private ventures, a 20% tax credit. States then offer their own sort of independent matching grant, as it were. Ours for many years has been one of the lowest in the country at 5%. Some states have none at all. But the Midwestern states we're around have another 20 or 25% matching. So what that means is in a historic building, the qualifying, and this gets reviewed by the National Park Service, the remodeling that qualifies and is done properly can get up to 40% as a tax credit to assist developers to save buildings.
Well, and you say the National Park Service reviews the kinds of restoration that's been done. Is there a right way to do this and a wrong way to do this?
Yeah, there really is. There are methods that are sort of accepted on a national level. They're time tested. They've been around since the 70s when the Preservation Act was passed and has been implemented through the tax credit program. So it really forces an owner and a contractor and a builder really to do things appropriately that are historically correct and that really can endure. And there's a lot of cheap and inexpensive ways to retain and reuse historic buildings.
Now, I think you've made the case that the state will completely recover the cost of these tax credits within 7 years. How does that happen?
The tax credits, there's a number of interesting kind of dimensions or components to the tax credit program here in Wisconsin and other states for that matter. The tax credits are offered after the completion of the project. And when you're talking several million-dollar restoration projects, that might take a year or two to finish that construction. The taxes are then taken from Wisconsin, from Madison, over a progressive period of time after that for a couple of years. So though the program is talked about at least last year as having $35 million of approved tax credits, those tax credits don't end up being requested from Madison for quite a few years. As a matter of fact, this very first year, only $4.9 million of tax credits were requested from Madison. So there's a real clarification that needs to go on with the actual budget impact of this program. So given that, you have projects, you contractors hire workers, they get salaries, they have to pay taxes those years. They can't advance that kind of tax responsibility to 3 or 4 years after the project is through. They pay that immediately. So when you look at these numbers very carefully, you see both that very obvious data that shows that more money is going in by way of taxes for workers and products and materials that are purchased, but then also the economic impact, the stimulus, particularly the catalytic stimulus, particularly in smaller towns around Wisconsin. This is one of the few programs that, you know, a downtown can use to stimulate renewal in their downtowns. And so it might be one building, maybe a $500,000 project, but it'll start to sort of catalytically stimulate buildings, coffee shops, things like that around it because it's there. So when you kind of put that all in, as Baker Tilly did in the report we gave, you get a very, I think, sophisticated and clear understanding of the depth of the impact of these investments in towns around Wisconsin.
Well, and if I get what you're saying, I mean, I think the rub some may have suggested is that a program like this disproportionately benefits a city like Milwaukee, but you would contend that that is not the case.
Yeah, you know, and I think, again, that this past year is great evidence of that. Up until last year, we were averaging 11 projects in the state per year. This past year, as a lot of us know now, there were 31 projects accounting for $35 million. But when you look at those projects, there is a really nice and broad quality to them around the state of Wisconsin, from Baraboo to small towns, Schofield, De Pere, Eau Claire, La Crosse, Waukesha, and so forth. And a lot of times these are smaller projects. So what happens in the small town with the smaller projects is the developer and owner can now say, well, with this credit, I can now undertake a restoration or reuse of my building, whereas I couldn't have before without the credit. So in the past, a lot of those projects have been in kind of urban centers because they're sophisticated developers and contractors. So really the bottom line of increasing the tax credit is that it gets spread out more broadly around the state for even small projects to be able to use.
At the same time, for people listening around here who may spend some time in downtown Milwaukee, what are the kinds of projects that have been undertaken within the Milwaukee city limits that people might recognize?
Sure. There's a number of really great ones. I think a lot of Milwaukeeans will remember the Pritzloff Hardware building that you see from 794 when you look south at the Amtrak station. And for those of us who have been around for a long time now, we remember decades of a black building sitting there on St. Paul and Plankinton. We had a terrific building owner who undertook the restoration of this project in 2007-08, right at the verge of the real estate collapse. And he certainly was in a difficult way. But with the elevated tax credits, he was able then to continue the project that's being continued today that wouldn't have without the elevated tax credit. On Wisconsin Avenue, the Posner Building, we know that, right across the street from the Grand Avenue Mall. These buildings have been sitting either vacant or at a very low level of use for a long time, and without the tax credits, these were impossible to undertake. You see the Florida Lofts, that's right next to the Iron Horse Hotel. That'll be completed pretty shortly, and again, a cleaned-off building that is bringing life and sort of 24/7 now to the Fifth Ward. The Paper Box Lofts are also on the south side, 1560 West Pierce, again, an unused loft building that is bringing sort of not only, reuse to the building, but then the people, particularly as these are residential projects that are there, again, 24/7. They're there on the weekends. They're there in the evenings. And all of a sudden, street life gets – and as I said before, it's got that catalytic thing. All of a sudden, across the street, we're starting to see the coffee shops and the other places that can service those new residents in that area.
Now, presumably, these buildings that we're talking about, they, when they were constructed, probably replaced buildings that were there before that. What about this idea that when some of these buildings were built, they weren't necessarily conceived of as, you know, the builder didn't put it up thinking, well, this thing is going to be here for another 200 years or 150 years. You know, how do you rank what's worth saving and what's not?
Well, you know, that is – it's a really important question to ask, and I think it's important to retain sort of legitimacy to this whole matter of retaining heritage if we can as a kind of community decide which ones have the virtue to be saved. So the National Park Service, the local commission that I sit on, we evaluate these buildings and use a number of criteria, 9 criteria. Do they satisfy these criteria? Not all buildings are locally designated or nationally designated. You might get that impression, but there are a lot fewer buildings that are protected and have the tax credits available to them because you have to be listed nationally to be able to get the tax credit. So there's actually a fairly limited amount. But I want to answer one other thing related to your question. These buildings, and I think it perhaps shows up the best in the challenge that architects are going to have now for the next few decades. And that is the retention of a fundamentally different building stock, mid-century modernist buildings, which we all kind of know. They're glassy buildings.
We're in one now, right?
Yes, we're in a very substantial one. But a lot of the ones that were done at that time were done with materials and technologies that had been sort of created in advance in the mid part of the century and that are going to be very delicate and very expensive buildings to restore in the future. These loft buildings that we oftentimes see as being tax credit projects were built with the incredible amount of kind of sturdy, durable materials. They were sort of they were manufacturing and storage places. We all know them. We go to the Third Ward, the Fifth, we see the heavy timber, we see the thick masonry walls, the punched openings. They're durable buildings. And like their sort of European ancestors, buildings get reused for different purposes over and over, and particularly when they're substantially built. So it's not that odd to sort of say that here's a storage building, now it's a residential building. But as I said, we're going to be faced as architects with a much tougher task, and that is the lighter, the more contemporary modern buildings that are more flimsy and have less substantial materials in them.
It seems like a cliche, but if I get what you're saying correctly, they really don't make them like they used to.
Well, one could kind of say that on a certain level. I don't want to indict all modern architecture or anything like that. And certainly the building that we're in right now is very substantial. But I think that it perhaps nowadays it's easier to do a lightweight, real fast, quickly constructed building that doesn't have substantial materials. It's easier to do now. Maybe they would have done that 130 years ago, or perhaps. They just quite didn't have those technologies. They had the German and Polish masons, and labor was inexpensive, and materials to a certain degree, heavy timber, that was pretty plentiful. It was all around here. So really the costs of putting together a substantial building are far different than they are today, with higher labor costs and imported materials from other countries.
Well, Matt Jarris, thank you so much for adding some perspective to this story.
Great, Mitch. Thank you very much for having me.
Matt Jarris is a Milwaukee architect and directs the Historic Preservation Institute at UWM. You'll find a link to the Baker-Tilly Report on the Economic Impact of the Historic Tax Credit Program at WUWM.com.